Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Robin Young, it's Here and Now. Negotiating towards a midnight deadline in Baghdad, Shiite and Kurdish Iraqi politicians say they've come up with enough votes to pass a draft constitution with or without the minority Sunnis. A draft constitution, already delayed a week, is something President Bush is pushing for as poll numbers in this country reflect doubts about the war in Iraq, and some Republican leaders begin voicing serious concerns about U.S. policy there. We'll have more on that in a moment, but first, joining us on the line from Baghdad, Los Angeles Times correspondent Borzu Daragahi. Borzu, this draft constitution, so who's on board?
Well, this draft constitution is, it's something they probably could have done a week ago. The Shiites and the Kurds, who are Iraq's dominant political and ethnic groups, have decided that they're going to pretty much cut out certain very nationalist Sunni Arabs and just go for it and pass a constitution. Now, this constitution will sort of deflect a lot of questions. There's going to not address a lot of issues, sort of leave them for later. And the thinking is that, you know, this will persuade at least some Sunni Arabs. Those are the people who are leading the insurgency. At least some Sunni Arabs will sign on.
Well, and what are those issues? The autonomy of the different regions, the who controls the oil, some of the sticking points, are those going to be put aside?
Yeah, absolutely. They're going to call it a federal Iraq, but they're not going to spell out what that means.
Well, what's going to happen at the ballot box when Iraqis vote on this draft constitution in October if Sunnis are pretty much cut out?
It's not going to be that easy for the Sunnis to get the two-thirds majority in three provinces that the law requires for them to overturn the constitution.
Borzu, what about the role of Islam and the role of women in the constitution?
Well, details are still sketchy, and I have to caution that we're not exactly sure how it's going to turn out. But it looks like they're going to pass a pretty watered-down, pretty liberal law with regard to Islam. Islam will be mentioned as the religion of the state, but it will also be regarded as a and not the source for legislation. People themselves will be able to choose their own how their laws of divorce and family are going to be governed according to their own religion and beliefs. But let me make one point. And that is that, you know, whatever this constitution says, the reality is that in Iraq, and you'll hear everyone saying this, the country is being increasingly run by religious militias that, regardless of what is written in the law books, they do whatever they want and they enforce Islamic law however they want.
Borzu Daragahi is Baghdad correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Well, as politicians in Iraq negotiate their constitution, a growing number of Republican politicians in this country are becoming more critical of the president's policy there. Yesterday, Republican Senator and possible presidential candidate Chuck Hagel of Nebraska used the V word, saying on ABC's This Week program that the U.S. is getting bogged down in Iraq as it did in Vietnam.
What we need in Iraq is either a strategy to win or a strategy to get out. You got to either do it right or get out.
And perhaps hoping to staunch the criticism, President Bush begins a 3-day break from his Texas ranch vacation to speak first to veterans in Salt Lake City today, then National Guard troops and families in Idaho on Wednesday. Well, we wanted to check in with John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. John, so Senator Hagel is saying stay the course. Staying the course is not policy. Do other Republicans agree with him?
Not so far, Robin. It's the president's still among rank-and-file Republicans. His approval is still in the range of 90%. And most of the major Republicans, including John McCain, who is an old friend of Chuck Hagel, who is still considered the front-runner for the 2008 Republican nomination, he's still with the president in sticking with the policy the president has, perhaps even adding more troops to stabilize the security situation. But Republican politicians are getting worried as they look forward to 2006 that there's a sense of drift in terms of what's happening in Iraq, and that the administration needs to provide some clearer signs for the American people that this is worth it.
Well, White House officials told USA Today that they're worried about the erosion of support from military families, that if relatives of soldiers turn against the war or U.S. policy. The larger U.S. public will quickly follow. We see Gold Star mother Cindy Sheehan camped out outside of the Crawford Ranch. Do you think that's true, that thinking about the relatives of soldiers?
Well, I do think it's true. If relatives of soldiers begin turning against the war, the president and the administration has real trouble. Now, I think the evidence that they are turning against it is not all that great at the mm-hmm. moment. Cindy Sheehan has become a rallying point for those people who are nervous about the war. But one of the realities of the volunteer army we have, Robin, is that most Americans are somewhat cut off from the sacrifices that have to be borne. And the president so far, this was certainly true in the 2000 election, has enjoyed fairly strong support from military families. We see that when he goes to military bases and military communities and gets a strong reception. If that goes, you know the bottom's fallen out of the Bush's policy, but it hasn't happened yet.
John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Was this a good move for the president to make these visits today and this week and the few seconds we have?
I don't think he's got any choice, Robin. There are too many Americans who are feeling nervous about this situation. He's got to take advantage, certainly now at a time, August, when he can dominate the news, to come out and say, here's why we're doing it and here's why it's going to work.
John, thank you.
You bet.
Liberia has been off the news radar for a while, but now presidential elections in that troubled African nation are gaining international attention as candidates take to their second week of campaigning in the country founded by freed American slaves more than 150 years ago. Voters go to the polls in October for the first presidential election since Charles Taylor was forced into exile 2 years ago in a deal that ended 14 years of civil war. Taylor is also facing war crimes charges. Well, leading the field of 22 candidates to replace him are a 38-year-old international soccer star and a 70-year-old political stalwart. Polls show that soccer phenom George Weah, known as King George in Liberia, has gained a huge following. His main contender is Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, a Harvard-educated politician who would become the first woman to lead an African nation. I met Ms. Sirleaf when she was in Boston earlier this month to drum up support among Liberians living in the U.S. She told me then that thousands of Liberians are now living in the U.S. after fleeing the civil war there.
300,000 Liberians resident in the United States, you know, throughout all the states.
Yeah.
Quite a large number and quite an important resource for our country, both in terms of the remittances that they send back to their family and friends, the support which they give to the political process, and the reservoir of talent which we can tap once we have if democratically elected government that creates the environment of security and confidence for them.
Mm. Well, that explains why you're here in the United States. It does not explain why you want this job. As has been pointed out, two of the last three men who held it were brutally executed. One, President Doe, had his ears cut off and bled to death in a bathtub. You are grimacing, but it was a horrible death. His remains paraded through the streets. He was overthrown by Charles Taylor, who is now under indictment for crimes against humanity. It is not a job that seems to come to a good end.
And that's exactly why I'm interested, because I think the risk is there, no doubt, but the challenge is enormous and the challenge is real. It's a challenge to lead the effort for a rigorous reform agenda that enables us to move from dependency to productivity, enables us to, you know, to be able to have our people as true stakeholders in the country. By changing our political system so there's better participation and there's the devolution of power from the center to the periphery, to be able to put the emphasis on development so that the basic needs of our people are responded to and their dignity is restored, mm-hmm. the disadvantages and inequities that have characterized, you know, much of our national effort needs to be redressed. And my interest is to change Liberia. I've been involved in the political process in one way or the other for some 20 years. I've spoken out against it with certain consistency for now four regimes. And finally, maybe I'll get the opportunity to introduce those structural changes that will ensure that we never go back to war.
Well, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, something you just said raises another tough question that I know that you are asked. You have been involved with the political process, and some question, does that make you part of the problem? Let's go to what your detractors say. In the early days of the Civil War, You sided, according to them, with Charles Taylor as he overthrew then-President Doe. You allegedly made a statement that some say is coming back to haunt you in the early days of that civil war in Liberia. The statement was, level Monrovia, the capital, and we will build it. So what do you say about whether you supported Charles Taylor then, what that means, what that should mean now?
Well, you know, let me say that my involvement goes further back than Charles Taylor. The Doe government took over in 1980. I was Minister of Finance. I was one of the few that was saved from execution. In a way, people say I supported Doe. But when Doe went off the track, I again challenged him and I again joined those who brought out that his government was not responsive, his government has atrocity, his government was lawless. And so when that happened and the Charles Taylor movement started, I was in exile with a few other compatriots. And again, we thought this was a South African style, a military operations that would support the political challenge to a military regime that was repressive.
This was Charles Taylor.
Which
reminds people, when Charles Taylor overthrew President Doe, there were many people who thought that was a good thing because President Doe's tenure had become, as you said, repressive.
People forget that and try to lay blame, but the majority of Liberians supported this because we thought we were now moving from, you know, military repression to someone who was advocating change and good government. And
Charles Taylor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it all proved to be untrue. Mm-hmm. He betrayed the many people who attempted to support his movement in the early days because very quickly we show it was a grab for power, it was a grab for personal enrichment. And the statement which you said, yes, I was in Washington when Focus on Africa called and just asked me a question. You know, there are bombs being thrown from all sides, from Taylor, from Doe. Mm. The nation is under siege. And the only way Doe is going to leave is if the mansion is destroyed. And I said, if they destroy it, we'll rebuild it. I tell you, I've said to Liberians, if in my 20-plus years, you know, of political involvement and political consistency and political advocacy, the only thing they can point to is, oh, at one point she said, if they destroy the mansion, she'll rebuild it. I feel very proud of my record. Mm-hmm. I think that's a little dot in a whole sea of things that I've done to bring us to this point of progress.
Well, I want to talk more about those and your credentials because there are many. You're said to be one of the most credentialed candidates in the field. But just more on the perception problem, because it's been said that the only candidate without blood on his hands in the race is an international soccer star and icon, you know him, George Weah, who might win just because people perceive him, you know, he's a soccer player, so far outside of the political process.
Oh, I wouldn't give much credence, you know, to that statement. There's so many candidates who have worked for change, and I dare say, if we had not been consistent in addressing the atrocities, in calling for change, in struggling to bring our country to the place where we can have an environment in which we have the likelihood of free and fair elections, the popular people would not today even have a chance. Mm-hmm. But I think let's give credit to whom credit is due. The many people who suffered in exile, who were jailed, who were tortured, you know, who went through all kinds of difficulties with successive regimes because they took positions of principle and stayed consistent in pointing out the wrongs of our country.
Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is running against a soccer superstar for president of Liberia. When we come back, how she plans to get the lights on and the water running in that troubled country. Much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing our conversation with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, one of 22 people running for president of Liberia. Her opponents include a former soccer star and a former rebel leader, but Sirleaf's resume is long. In addition to holding office in Liberia, she's worked for the World Bank and was in charge of the UN Development Program for Africa. I spoke recently with Mrs. Sirleaf and asked her how she hopes to rebuild war-torn and impoverished Liberia.
We start with, first of all, trying to ensure peace, stability, and reconciliation, as we can't do anything unless we do that. And that means, you know, being able to put together a team, a government that reflects the diversity of our population, you know, reaching out to all of those who have been affected by the civil wars, trying to make sure that they too feel like they have a stake. Trying to put the past behind us, you know, as ugly as that past is.
How do you do that? I mean, for instance, would you insist that Charles Taylor be tried for war crimes?
Well, let me put it this way. I think the issue of Charles Taylor has now reached a point where some decision needs to be made. Charles Taylor left the country under an arrangement, a deal with the West African leader supported by the UN and the United States, in which he'd go into exile in Nigeria and he would stay out of Liberian politics and out of West African politics.
But a member of his party's running.
Well, that's what I'm saying. He has not kept the deal. Mm-hmm. He's violated and disrespected the understanding he had. And if that is so and the evidence is there to show it, then he should bear the consequences. Mm-hmm. And I believe that the three countries' head of state, which include Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, have recently, I suppose on the basis of the evidence available to them, taking exactly that position in calling upon Nigeria to have Mr. Taylor bear the consequences for his interference, not only in Liberian affairs, but in the sub-region.
How do you get the most basic things accomplished? Water, jobs, good sewage systems. I mean, all the systems that have broken down. How do you jumpstart that?
In the first instance, we need to manage our own resources properly. Mm-hmm. We've not done that. Corruption has taken away from any effort to restore basic services to the people. So we're going to do that.
Well, you have a diamond industry, timber exports.
Liberia is amply endowed, and Liberia's population of 3 million, small. There's no reason for our country to be poor the way it is and for our people to suffer the way they have. Mm. If we manage our resources properly and we create the environment whereby there's confidence, not only for Liberians to return home, which is our greatest asset anyway, but where we'd be able to attract private capital, private investment, because we have a government that's responsive, a government that's efficient and effective, you know, that is committed to development. I believe that it's not going to be a long period of time before the basic things to which you refer, water, lights, you know, the repair of our infrastructure like roads, our schools and our health systems, that we can do it. Our country is not poor. Our country has just had poor leadership.
Hmm. Can I ask you something related to the history? You mentioned reconciliation, and I'm curious. As we said, Liberia, founded by freed American slaves who went there in 1821, declared independence in 1847, and then pretty much ruled the country until the 1980 coup, when then Sergeant Doe overthrew the existing government. But these freed slaves and their descendants who ruled the country until 1980 were a minority. It was mostly indigenous Africans in the country, correct?
That's correct. And you know, that's one of our problems, that one of the historical contributors to the problem we face today and to the civil wars that have wrecked our countries. Because we did have a small group representing the settler population that monopolized power and privilege to the exclusion of the majority indigenous group. Over time, that has diminished, you know, intermarriage, the ward system, education. And in fact, it's that cleavage in the society that led to the radicalization of the society in the 1960s, and that set the basis for the coup d'etat
in 1980.
Now we've got to not only accept that history because we can't change it, but we've got to confront it, mm-hmm. and we've got to be able to make sure that this very small minority of so-called Americo-Liberians, you know, representing the settler population, make sure that they're just another group of Liberians. They have no right to any special privileges. In fact, they do not even have the power anymore to do it.
But you also have to protect them from...
That's right. And that's very important what you say, that even though historically they may have had those who monopolize power, you have young ones among them who are not claiming any entitlement to anything else but being a Liberian and wanting to share equally and be protected equally like any other Liberian. Mm-hmm. And that's our challenge.
Yeah, I would think so, because that inequality set off the first coup in 1980, and the country's been spiraling ever since.
That's correct.
It would seem as if you can't quite get back on track until that's addressed.
I mean, and we have other kinds of cleavages in a society. We had an attempt for the domination and monopolization of power by one tribe, you know, when mm-hmm. President Doe was in power. We've had recently cleavages or on religious grounds, you know, Muslims against Christians. Our challenge and our objective is to bring all Liberians together as Liberians, irrespective of tribe, religion, background, and for us to have a national identity in which we subscribe to the notion that Liberia comes first, that we are all Liberians first. And we have to build this. That's the only way we can truly reconcile in a sustainable way. I have a feeling that Liberians are ready for this because everyone has suffered in those wars. The wars were no respecter of person. Every tribe, every group, suffered almost equally. And that, to me, provides the basis upon which we can build and we can reconcile.
Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, again, a candidate for president in the upcoming October elections in Liberia. Thank you for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
And we spoke to Ellen Johnson Sirleaf earlier this month during her visit to Boston. This note, since that time, Liberia's interim government has made its first formal request to have Charles Taylor extradited to neighboring Sierra Leone to stand trial for war crimes. And tomorrow on Here and Now, Northwest Airlines stays in the air while the mechanics walk out. We look at how the strike affects the airline industry and the future of labor negotiations. More ahead Here and Now. It's Here and Now. What happens when a sick child dies because a medical device malfunctions? Well, in many cases, the family might file a lawsuit, but that did not happen in our next story. The Walsh family of Reading, Massachusetts, decided instead to start a foundation to help develop better medical devices for children. Here Now's Alan Cockle has the story.
Oh, I just bumped into an apple.
It's 5 o'clock on a quiet tree-lined street in Reading. Kevin Walsh is home early from his job as a retirement planner. His wife Lynette is here as well with their two boys, Tyler 6, playing a video game, and Brendan, not yet 2, standing at the window. But this family scene is missing one person. A photo on the wall shows the chubby, smiling face of the baby daughter they called Casey Girl.
They all do have a different personality, and she was very, it's funny because we would say how Tyler was very boy and she was very girl.
Casey's mother, Lynette.
She was very, very dainty and just kind of petite, and you know, she was kind of girly. I mean, it was challenging, but I mean, I think both of us can say without a doubt that we wouldn't replace that challenge for anything in the world.
Casey was born with severe medical problems, including hydrocephalus, an excess of fluid around her brain. Doctors implanted a device called a shunt, a kind of drain to ease the pressure in her skull. The first few months of Casey's life were tough. There were other surgeries as well, and she had to be fed through a tube. But by the time she was 1 year old, things had been looking up. Until, Kevin and Lynette recall, the day that everything changed.
It was actually a great day. I mean, she was eating more.
She was pulling herself up on the couch. She was crawling around using her forearms. And myself, I always remembered that day, thinking to myself, you know, here was this girl who was 3 months ago was fighting for life, and she had grown to the point where she was pretty typical 1-year-old, and that day I came home from work, she slept a little bit more than usual.
It may have been like 2.5 hours to 3 hours.
When we stayed up late, you eventually said, why don't I go to bed? And probably within a half hour, Lynette came in upset that she wasn't responding.
They rushed Casey first to one hospital and then another, but she wouldn't wake up. Kevin and Lynette held their daughter as her life slipped away. The cause of death, a malfunction of the shunt, which led to a buildup of pressure in her brain.
I have one here, and this is a valve which has a little ruby ball in it.
Casey's neurosurgeon was Joe Madsen at Children's Hospital in Boston. A lot of families would have sued if they lost a child to a malfunctioning medical device, but the Walshes say they never even considered it. Instead, they started a foundation with one of its aims, the support of Madsen's efforts to design a better shunt, a technology that Madsen says hasn't fundamentally changed in over 40 years.
I think a lot of the problem that there has been relatively little research on hydrocephalus, there's been little research funded by the National Institute of Health. I think a lot of the reason that there hasn't been more progress is that people have considered this a solved problem. That we now know how to take care of this. It's a simple operation. It's a simple device. We don't need to go any further in it, and we should think about other things.
Madsen is now working on a new smart shunt, an improved device that uses microelectronic sensors to adjust to the waves of pressure inside the heads of babies and children with hydrocephalus. He says the lack of research funds is a major problem in pediatric device research. Only 3% of total U.S. health spending is on children, and 20% of children have no medical insurance. That means device makers have little reason to go after a pediatric market. In a sixth-floor operating theater at Children's Hospital, cardiologist Jim Locke is preparing to operate on a little boy named Trevor. An oxygen tube is in the boy's nose as he slumbers peacefully. His body disappearing under an expanse of green surgical cloth seems impossibly small.
Good enough. Let's load the device. This is a big hole, son. No wonder.
Locke calls for a cardioseal, a long sheath that he threads through a vein in the boy's leg up into his chest to place a clamp that will close a hole in his heart. Locke invented the cardioseal for child patients just like Trevor, but most of the market for the device is in adults.
The only reason we were able to persuade biomedical device companies to invest in making that device is that we did research and found that there were literally millions of Americans who might have a completely separate hole in their heart. And that hole might actually be the source of strokes or even migraine headaches. Once we figured out that it might be possible to use a device like this to close a hole that affected millions of adult Americans, it became possible to obtain the research and development and regulatory funds necessary to do both.
Locke calls this reverse engineering the market. But because of the high cost of the Food and Drug Administration approvals process, including the extra studies that might be required for children, it means a lot of medical devices in use for kids have never formally been approved for children. And not every device has an adult application. One of the challenges in designing for children is that they grow. Surgeons often use a tube called a stent to prevent blood vessels from collapsing. In adults, one size fits all, but the thread-sized stent in the tiny artery of a newborn is only good if it can expand as the child grows. Jim Locke invented just such a device, but no U.S. manufacturer has been willing to bring it to market because of the expense. Regulatory costs are lower in Europe, so Locke's device is on the market there. But that's not much help to the doctor's American patients.
The regulatory pathway in other countries is not as difficult as it is in this country. So, for example, in Europe, the amount of regulation and research that's required is not as rigorous as it is here. So you can get a device to market in Europe for much less money than you can in the United States. And in fact, people in Europe just in the last 6 months have started to make this device.
Can you now get that for your patients?
No. No, we can't.
With medical devices, as with drugs, the FDA faces two opposite and powerful pressures: to make new technology available to patients and to ensure its safety. Congress has passed laws extending patent protection to pharmaceutical companies that study their drugs in children. But patent protection is weaker in the device industry, and manufacturers say similar incentives wouldn't work there. Children's Hospital in Boston has established a project aimed at working closely with manufacturers and obtaining federal grants to reduce the cost of bringing devices to market. But one of the most effective ways of promoting new technology has been through private philanthropy, wealthy donors or foundations like the one started by Kevin and Lynette Walsh in honor of their daughter Casey.
This foundation is about Casey, and it's about those things that were important to her. And I think when we looked at this maybe smaller niche of the medical community that we found ourselves in, you know, the reality of it is there really hadn't been any significant medical advancements in, you know, what, 20, 25 years, maybe even longer. You know, maybe in the bottom of our hearts that we hope someday that there's, you know, maybe a family much like ours who gets the opportunity to spend, you know, a long, fruitful life with their child.
The Casey Girl Foundation has raised more than $80,000 so far. They're just one of a handful of private donors putting money towards the development of medical devices for children. Doctors driving the research say it won't change the system, but it helps.
Our piece on the Walsh family and their work in making medical devices for children was produced by Here and Now's Alan Cockle. Well, still to come, we note the passing of Robert Moog, the man who helped bring beautiful music to rock and roll. You're listening to Here and Now. When my friend, the fabulous Johnny Miller, first offered me his tickets to last night's Rolling Stones concert at Boston's Fenway Park, I had a rare attack of ennui. You see, Johnny is a sports reporter. The Sox are on the road, and so is he. And it was an incredibly generous gesture. It was going to be the first date on the Stones' 37-city A Bigger Bang tour, their 31st world tour, and only the third rock concert at Fenway Park. A combination of my two favorite things, with Fenway slightly edging out rock and roll. But I don't know, a stadium concert on a hot Sunday night. I'd have a wash to fold, I'm sure. I'd pledge to spend more quality time with my dog. I wasn't sure if I wanted to go. What was I thinking?
Alive and hope and sex and dreams are still surviving on the street. Love me! I'm shattered!
It was terrific. Much has been made of how Mick and the boys are actually older men, but in their 60s, they played as if it was the 60s. From Start Me Up through Shattered, Satisfaction, Brown Sugar, Sympathy for the Devil. By the way, it was really cool to hear 35,000 people singing the woo-woo from that song. The venue was spectacular, our little jewel of a bandbox transformed by what was billed as the biggest stage in the world. 5 stories high, it ran from left field along the green wall to right field just short of the foul pole. Mick pranced the stage like the Nureyev of rock that he is, at one point running from one side all the way to the other and back again. Outfielder Johnny Damon would have been impressed. And there's something so sweet about a 60-something-year-old man confident enough to skip, which Mick did all night. Other highlights of the show besides the hits, a tribute to Stone's idol, the late Ray Charles, and a new swamp-drenched blues bit called Back of My Hand, featuring a sweaty Mick on slide guitar.
I'll say I can really like the back of my hand. Is that right?
The Stones didn't play their other much-ballyhooed new song, Sweet Neocon. In fact, the only politics of the night were some jabs at California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who bought a big block of tickets to resell and raise money for his campaign coffers. By the way, isn't that scalping? And the Stones did play She's So Cold for the first time ever live. My friend Susan pronounced it the greatest concert she's ever seen. And it was good. It was very, very good. But it wasn't 40 years ago last week when another band played another ballpark, the first major outdoor stadium concert in America.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone.
I can't remember how or why, but I was there on August 15, 1965, when the Beatles played Shea Stadium, and some sort of alchemy sent 60,000 mostly young people into a transcendent frenzy that lasted without a pause all night. There was no concert protocol, no cell phones held aloft. The whole evening grossed just $304,000. The Beatles took home only $160,000. My friend Debbie Covage took home Ringo's drum cover after we stormed the tiny little stage. There were no fireworks except for what was happening in our hearts, which wasn't happening in my heart last night. And when I remarked on that, my friend Lenny said, I know just what you mean. You see, last year at Fenway, he caught a foul ball. As it sailed into his hand, his one thought was, why couldn't this have happened 40 years ago when instead of just being great, it would have killed me? And that's it. We were shocked to find ourselves screaming for the Beatles as if our hearts would break. 40 years later, we've all lived through heartbreak. There are few new emotions for the Stones to mine. Mick, don't get me wrong. You were good. You were very, very good. But I'm sure you'll understand. You were not my first. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. Robin Young, It's Here and Now. The man responsible for the synthesized sounds that sparked the age of electronic music and gave bands like the Beatles an incredible tool has died. Robert Moog developed his first voltage-controlled modulated synthesizers in 1964, but not before failing at his intended goal, selling electronic kits. Here's Moog speaking with WBUR in 2002.
As my graduate studies came to an end, I began to wonder what I was going to do for a living, and we decided, well, I might as well get it out of my system. We might as well let me try and build kits. The first kit was not a big success. It was a battery-powered musical instrument amplifier kit, which I saw a need for, but not many other people did. But in the process of trying and failing at that, I met a musician who asked me if I knew anything about electronic music.
Well, as it turned out, he didn't, but was willing to learn. His timing was serendipitous. As the Moog synthesizer hit the market, the Beatles and others were looking for ways to fuse their psychedelic experiences with their music. Moog's genius was most recently recognized in 2004 at a New York City festival celebrating the synthesizer's 50th birthday.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun, I say, it's all right.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com, and by REMAX of New England, a source for real estate assistance in New England, featuring an online renovation guide, agent locator, and comprehensive property search, REMAX-NewEngland.com.